Good evening.
Good evening, Malka.
How are you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
Baruch Hashem, I'm well.
Good, glad to hear it. We've been having some nice weather.
Well, we had some rain in Atlanta today, but it's been nice most of the day.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hello, good evening.
Let us get started. We're in section 13 of Noah. We're on Pasuk 90, and I'll start with the Lashon Yehud. Lashon Yehud kudsha b'rithu ishkintei bit hilu erchimu ud hilu ud hilu erchimu. Le'akda l'shem yudhei bovavhei b'yichuda shalim b'shem kol Yisrael. Limud Torah mitzvah. La'asok Torah mitzvah. Vayhino am Adonai Eloheinu aleinu ma'asei adeinu konenei aleinu ma'asei adeinu konenehu. Wekad kamu lewae, wekad la ketala, kedein itar ivya, isha wachawazil, kamaihu velayakil, veshalta abeho. Begin de hawo Yisrael mizdarzin, Salho v'chagiru, Nezanan v'layakil, Ahu nachash v'shal ta'a, V'ho, v'kevan di'amar, L'moshe v'yata, Hored ed yecha, Me'alecha, it yehev, Rishu lehai nachash l'shalta'a alayhu. And when the Levites rose up to slay the guilty, that is, when Moses told them, put every man his sword by his side and slay every man his brother, then the evil serpent walked in front of them. Nevertheless, he could not dominate them because all Israel were girt with a special armor that protected them against his attacks. This special armor is the ornament that they received at Mount Horeb. Thus, the serpent could not have prevailed against them. However, when he said to Moses, "Therefore, now put off your ornaments from yourself," permission to rule over Israel was given to the serpent. Questions, comments, thoughts?
I don't remember the reference that they give in Shemot 32:27. Put every man his sword by his side and slay every man his brother. I don't remember
that's
that.
When Moses said, that's at the golden calf, after the building of the golden calf. The Levites did not participate in that. And so Moses ordered them to kill, I believe it was 3,000 of the people who participated in the actual building of the golden calf.
Okay.
Not everybody participated, but those who did were slain by the Levites. And that's what the reference is to.
Okay. Were most of those Erevav? Because we don't hear from them after a point.
No. According to the Zohar in one of the Midrashim, there were only two people that are considered heir of Rav. They were the children or the grandchildren of Laban.
Okay.
They were magicians who had studied in Egypt. They were taught by Bilam. The two of them, the direct literal translation of Erev Rav is large evening.
Mm-hmm.
So the way the magicians work, according to this midrash that we read in the Zohar, the way the magicians work, there were those who were skilled and had been taught how to bring their magic during the daylight hours. And then there were those who were taught how to bring their magic in the evening hours, after 9 p.m. essentially. And the only two of them came with two of the Erev Ravs, two of the large magicians, large evening magicians, came with the community that Moses brought along with them. And they knew that it was time for their great-grandfather, Laban, to elevate through the eating of grass, that it was time for him to elevate to the next level to become an animal. And so by manipulating Aaron into building the golden calf, his soul was animating the golden calf. And that's what their work was. So there's only two people that are considered Erev Rav, although there is a Zohar in the prologue that we have studied that says there are five levels of Erev Rav. So there's five groups of people that came out of Egypt along with those two. And so with that understanding, the 3,000 people who were killed were not just Erev Rav. They were children of Israel who had fallen into the pattern of supporting the building of the golden calf.
Okay. I suppose the special armor was the Torah, since it says the special armor is the ornament that they received at Mount Horeb.
The special ornament was the letters that we study on Shavuot. The special ornaments when we read the Torah in each section, every one of the 24 books, there are two-letter sequences that come at the end of each book that we study.
Right, I remember we did portions of that last Shavuot or the Shavuot before. I remember that.
And those are the ornaments, and essentially those ornaments represent the wisdom of the Torah itself. They represent the protection shield, and they were, every one of the children of Israel had received those ornaments at Mount Horeb, which is another name for Mount Sinai, at the giving of the Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only when they built the golden calf, and even if they didn't physically build it, they didn't stop it, and so therefore they lost that ornament. And that's what it's referring to. Moses did not lose the ornaments, but that's why he had to wear a mask, because his light that was emanating from his head, from his face, was so bright that people couldn't look at his face. And he had to wear a mask except when he was connecting directly with Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is written in the Torah in the section of the golden calf, or right afterwards.
Right. Okay. I just didn't remember that bit about the Levites.
As long as we have those ornaments, we have protection from death. And that's why we stay up all night on Shavuot evening and study what we study to receive those ornaments. Only in our generation, it's not clear whether it just goes through Rosh Hashanah or does it go all year long. And that's the language of the Hebrew that the Ari wrote. So it's not clear. But for sure, it's through Rosh Hashanah. But we passed Rosh Hashanah. Now, why is it being discussed in the Parasha of Noah? That's a valid question to ask. But it's really relating to the similar discussions that we've just gone through in the 4, 5, 6 verses that we've gone through in this section. Because it's talking about Anatot, which is the poor person, someone who is in lack. And that's also what this verse is saying, is the various sephirot have, when it's in lack, the angel of death is given control over even the children of Israel. When they sin, when we sin, death was returned. That's what this verse is hinting at, more than hinting at. It's describing, this verse is describing how for 39 days death was concealed. The angel of death could not control a child of Israel for 39 days. But at the building of the golden calf, he was again given permission to control, meaning to cause someone from the children of Israel to die. And my teachers have said that as of the year 2000, that potential, we can rise above that. The angel of death still has control over those people who have not grown spiritually, but those who have, they can choose not to die. The angel of death has no control of them in our generation right now. But most people don't believe that. And if you don't have certainty about that, the result is the same as if it was never given. Are there any other questions or more questions on this subject now?
I'm not sure I can piece it all together, but it seemed like I remember something about after Passover, the children of Israel are given a crown, and that crown holds for 30 days, I guess, till second Passover. But I can't remember what that was linked to, so I don't know if it was worth mentioning, but my first thought when I saw ornament, I thought maybe, that's what struck my memory, but I have no, recollection of where I read that or studied it at one time. I'm sure around Passover, but
it's essentially what you're referring to, and yes, you are correct. But there's 33 days leading up to Lag BaOmer, and Lag BaOmer, that's that 30-day period that you're talking about from Pesach to second Pesach, it relates to the Sefirot that we count during the Omer. There are some people who say that the 49 days start on the first of Nisan and end at essentially on second Pesach. There are others who say it starts on the first of Iyar and ends on Shavuot. So there are these different opinions as to the start and stopping, but it's essentially the same discussion. Okay. Are the children of Israel immune from death? And for a period of time, they are. They are as soon as Yom Kippur is over, they are immune. We are immune from death until we sin. And we build the sukkah for 4 days, and so that there's no sins in those 4 days if we're busy with the mitzvot. But if we could avoid sinning, we would not be subject to death. That's really the message of all of these stories in Pasukim. You have the option. You just have to exercise the option. You have to remain elevated spiritually. And unfortunately, most people, even if they're taught this, don't have the certainty to make it work.
No. Hashem won't give it to us as a gift.
Go ahead, Malka.
Did each the letters that were written on the garments, or their shield, their ornament, written on their garments, were they all the same letters for each individual, or was there different ornaments for each tribe?
It's a good question, and I've never heard an answer to that question. As I'm thinking about it, you have 24 books in the Torah. So there would be, if it was the 12 tribes, you would have a pair of ornaments for each tribe. Or it could be that all 24 was for every person. It's just not clear, and I've never heard an answer on it. And you also have to remember, because it gets confusing, the 24 books of the Hebrew Bible are not the same 24 books in the Christian Bible. So people get very confused with that.
Yeah,
as an example, the book of First Samuel and Second Samuel is really one book in the Hebrew Bible.
Right.
But in the Christian Bible, it's two. The same, same with Kings 1 and 2 and Chronicles 1 and 2.
Well, the reason I asked, because each tribe had a banner, and each banner had a shorish on each pertaining to that tribe. So I thought maybe
Correct.
They had different so you have two letters for each.
The shield that the tribes are given, the flags that the tribes are given, is also a protection shield, but it's not, to me, it's not real clear as to what the flags actually are. They're very symbolic. In one of my teachers, Rabbi Barsadok, wrote a book called Protection from Evil, and he has probably 3 or 4 chapters in that book about symbolism of flags. Colors and metaphors, and it's really an esoteric subject, and I haven't read that book now probably for 5 or 6 years, and when I did read it, I did not understand those sections. Now, if I read it today, I might be able to understand it, but I haven't had time to go back and reread it.
And I have the book, but I don't remember reading that. So, and I bet it's been 5 years since I've read that book, too. I remember
prayers. Yes, I'm sure it has.
More than anything, I remember he had several prayers. That was what stands out in my mind.
Well, his main thrust is the Shema, the protection from evil. And earlier in the book, he explains the symbolism of things that he wrote. Yellow flags, yellow, there's some numbers. I forget what the numbers were, but he relates to what is a flag and what are the colors and how does the symbolism work. And it's early in the book if you want to take a look at it.
Yes, I do. Okay.
Should I go on?
Yes, I think so. Is that okay with you, Michael?
So the angel of death would have seen these ornaments on the individuals, and he had no power over them. Is that correct? It wasn't seen by by the normal eye. Okay.
Well, that's a leading question, Malka, because there is a meditation that I teach in the Sefer Yetzirah class about a candle in a mirror after midnight. And I don't know if you've ever heard of that meditation, but in that meditation, you're actually able, some people are able to perceive the letters that are on their forehead.
I'm going to have to mute.
Say again?
She has to mute. She got a phone call.
Understand. So there are letters, ornaments on every person. Most people are not able to see them, but a Kabbalist would be able to see them. And students of Kabbalah can use different techniques to be able to see them. So when you say it's not a normal thing that can be seen every day, that's really not true. It's just most people are not on the spiritual level to be able to see with that.
What
it's also...
excuse me, I thought you were finished.
There's a teaching in the Chinese medicine about how to take the pulse of someone and based on reading of the pulse, know what is wrong with them. What is the illness? And that's also part of the Kabbalah and what the Kabbalah teaches. But there's, nobody that I have heard of in our generation that's utilizing that technique except certain yogis in India and in China. But all of those techniques have been known in Judaism from the beginning. And when Mashiach comes, all of them will be revealed to everyone. Everybody's quiet again. I know Hannah's not muted, but Malka,
no,
are you okay?
I, I muted. It was my son's call, and I never, you know, I wanted to make sure it wasn't an emergency. But Tony had picked it up, so I came back on.
Okay. Malcolm, did you want to continue with that line of questions? We're almost done with our time anyway.
I'm not aware of the meditation, and but I would like to learn that. I just don't know when I'll have the time to fit that in.
I've tried to teach that as a group, and it's really the recommendation from the Talmud is that material should only be taught one-on-one and then only to someone who is already familiar with meditation on their own. So what the teacher does on a one-on-one in that situation is guide the student as to what they are experiencing in their own personal meditations.
Can we change the letters, or once it's there, it's a permanent mark?
No. The letters constantly change. They're basically, the letters are reflections of the emotions that are flowing through your mind and heart at any given moment. So they change instantly. And that's what makes it so difficult. You might see a letter, and then it'll change to another letter, and then it'll change back, and you go back and forth. It's like our thoughts. You know, our thoughts are significant. We go through, what, a million thoughts a second? And now we're talking about the thoughts of our heart. So it's very instantaneous. It flashes very quickly.
So would that be
the meditation I mentioned is really referring to the letters that you would see on your own forehead through the mirror. Because initially, those are the easiest things for you to understand. You see a letter, and then you get a sense of what that meaning of that letter is. To see it on another person, you have to be on a level that you can control your judgments about that. You have to be on the level of a Kabbalist who has a very difficult desire to receive in order to share, which is essentially, you know what the person needs to do for his or her tikkun, but if you tell them, you're taking away their free choice. And that's a very difficult fine line to walk. What makes the Kabbalists such a difficult situation. You have to sit and let someone make their own mistakes. It's like, as a parent, you have an 18-year-old child, you know they're making a mistake, but they're not going to listen to you to not make the mistake. So do you tell them and get into an argument with them, or do you just bite your tongue and watch them make the mistake? What do? You love them. You want to help them. You can shorten their process, but they're not ready to listen to you because they need to be independent. They have to make their own mistakes. And that is the difficulty of a true Kabbalist.
So that would be a tool that we could use to know where our spiritual energy needs to change from,
It's a tool to learn about yourself. And okay. Then once you know that, then you can start to implement your own changing. But in order to reach that level, you have to be willing to evaluate yourself honestly. We had this discussion the other day.
Right.
And it's very difficult for people to let go of the things they learned as children. And truly evaluate where they are, where each person is. I had a discussion with a student today along those same lines. This is the energy of Cheshvan. This is the discussion that we constantly have. I see what I expect to see. So how do I break out of that limitation and no longer expect to see it? I'm going to see the truth instead of what I expect to see. And how do you tell the difference? What I expect to see, isn't that the truth? No, that's the society that you've grown up in that has caused you to establish limitations on yourself. As an example, or as a discussion, we grew up in America. We were taught that all men are created equal. And then we were told that it's all men are created equal under the law. But as we look at how the law is being implemented in this country, we say that's the goal, but we see that it's not being done. And yet we know many people who say, but it is being done. Because the jury system provides for that. But does it really? Who is on a jury system? Is that really a peer for someone? If the people on the jury system are all teachers and doctors and lawyers and people who can get paid to be off work for jury duty, and they're the jury for someone who's a drug addict, who's accused of murder, or who's accused of stealing, are those 12 jurors really able to put themselves in that person's shoes and judge them properly? Or take it on another level. You have people who are taught in their religion that an abortion is murder. And so they expect, if they were ever to judge someone who was having an abortion, their values are set by that church and what they've absorbed. Whereas a Kabbalist would talk to the mother, would perceive the tikkun of the mother, the tikkun of the father, the tikkun of the child, the tikkun of the other siblings, and be able to determine what is the best answer to the situation for that soul that is in the womb. But that could never be explained to someone who's been raised with a fixed value that abortion is incorrect. Now, I'm not justifying it. I'm not saying that abortion is correct. it's relative to the souls involved. My sister had two abortions. My daughter had two abortions. Both of them feel an emotional attachment to those fetuses that are not in their life. They still dream about them. They're still aware of them. They talk to them. My sister passed when she was 70. She had the abortion when she was 42. And until the last day of her life, she was still dealing with her emotions over the abortion. It would have been her fourth and fifth child. Could I judge her and say that she shouldn't have done it? No, I don't have that spiritual level. But I worked with her to try and understand the cause and effect, and for her to make that decision in a healthy way. Did the same thing with my daughter. My daughter, it's been 7-8 years. My daughter still calls me from time to time with a discussion on this issue. This is not an easy thing for any woman to decide. And it's made more difficult by the emotional trauma of the society. And there is no right or wrong answer. It's always relative to the souls involved. So have I confused and aggravated the situation?
That's good to hear.
I didn't hear what you said, Hona. I'm sorry.
I said it was good to hear. I can remember when I was in the church world and hearing the priest talk against it. And I was a young mother at the time, and I related to myself. What if I felt I had to have an abortion? How would I deal with it? I just remember thinking those things, And I've always really felt sorry. I don't know if sorry was the word, empathy, I guess. I only know a few that have, two that have had abortions, and they can't seem to get over it completely. And I recommended to one that they name the child and talk to the child. And they had already asked for forgiveness and tried to compare it to other sins that you had the faith that Hashem would forgive you, of all things. So, you kind of just have to, I don't know, I feel sorry for them.
No, I understand. The things that I didn't add into this discussion that it really do apply, my mother had two miscarriages between the birth of my sisters and myself. My other daughter had two miscarriages on her own. These are not easy things for people to happen and how they deal with that.
Well, that mother instinct is so strong in a woman.
Because whether it's an abortion or it's a miscarriage, there's all these hopes and desires associated with pregnancy. And, you know, just to show you, to give you a sense of how warped I was 40 years ago, my sisters and I had just separated from my wife. My sister invited a small dinner party, which included me and my other sister. So the three of us were there, and then there were about three or four other people. And as we sat down to dinner, one of the gentlemen said, "So there's just the three of you." And without batting an eyelash, I said, "No, there used to be five, but we killed the other two off." And my sisters broke out laughing. I laughed, but the gentleman who asked the question couldn't understand the joke. And today I would never say that because I have much more sensitivity. But at that point in my life, dealing with my own emotions over the breakup of my marriage, it was an appropriate thing for me to say at that moment. It wasn't appropriate for other people, but it was very funny to my sisters, and we laughed about it up until the day they died. It's always relative to the souls involved. It's always relative to the tikkunim involved. And until you are on a level of a Kabbalist where you can see those letters and really know what is that person's tikkun in this particular instance, can you really make that judgment? So we will move on to verse 91 tomorrow.
Okay.
Thank 7 o'clock class tonight. Thank you. The 7 o'clock class tonight is an essay. We're continuing an essay that we left off 3 months ago by Rabbi Ashlag. So I'm not sure if it'll be as productive because we have to think back about what that essay is all about. But we'll be talking about it tonight in a few hours. You all have a beautiful evening.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.